Welcome to Ekhatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI.
Welcome back. Today we're doing a deep dive into, well, a truly monumental work, George Orwell's 1984. It's less a story sometimes and more a warning.
Oh, absolutely a warning. And you can't really get into it without understanding Orwell himself, Eric Arthur Blair. He wasn't just making things up. His experiences, you know, in Burma with the Imperial Police fighting in the Spanish Civil War.
Right, he saw authoritarianism up close.
Exactly, both sides of it, fascism and Stalinism. And it gave him this profound, deep-seated hatred for that kind of total control. It's baked into the book.
And that experience translates into his writing style too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That famous quote about his prose being like a window pane, just clear, direct.
Yes, very clear. He wrote 1984 while he was seriously ill, finished it around 1948, hence the title being that sort of inversion.
Published in 49. So it was an immediate response, really, to the rise of Soviet power and the way truth was being twisted. It definitely sits in that dystopian tradition.
It really does. And the core question it throws at you, the reader, is terrifyingly relevant. Can you even be human? Can you hold on to reality when the state literally controls everything? Your job, your thoughts, even what happened yesterday.
That's the terrifying heart of it. Winston Smith's struggle.
It's all about his struggle, yeah.
Okay, so let's set the scene. Where are we?
We're in London, but it's not London anymore. It's called Airstrip One, a province in this massive superstate, Oceania. And the feeling, the whole atmosphere is just gray, dilapidated. Orwell paints this picture of like a vile wind, the constant smell of boiled cabbage.
Ugh, yeah, sounds grim.
No.
Kind of pervasive decay.
Total decay, physical and, you know, spiritual, and looming over everything is the party. And Big Brother.
Ah, Big Brother. That face is iconic, isn't it? Always with the caption, Big Brother is watching you.
Everywhere. On posters, on coins, on the telescreens. It's this constant reminder you are never alone, never unwatched. And there's this perpetual war going on, always shifting enemies. Oceania, Eurasia, East Asia.
Right. And the party uses this constant state of emergency, this surveillance, to maintain absolute control. Let's talk about those mechanisms. The telescreens are key, aren't they?
Absolutely central. They blast propaganda at you, but crucially, they also watch and listen to you. Two-way surveillance, constantly.
So no privacy.
Yeah.
Anywhere.
None. And if you even look like you're thinking something unorthodox, the thought police might just disappear you.
It's chilling. And then there's the social structure.
Yeah.
Inner party, outer party.
Yeah, a rigid hierarchy. The tiny inner party at the top with all the power, the slightly larger outer party doing the administrative work, that's where Winston is, and then the vast majority, like 85%, are the proles.
The proles, who the party mostly just ignores, right?
Right.
Sees them as almost subhuman.
Pretty much. They're not considered a threat because they're not expected to have complex thoughts or political awareness. The party focuses its control on its own members.
Okay, so let's bring in Winston Smith. Tell us about him.
Winston is 39. He's described as frail. He's got this varicose ulcer on his ankle that always seems to be bothering him. He works at the Ministry of Truth.
Ministry of Truth,
mm-hmm.
Which, of course, does the opposite.
Exactly. That's the twisted irony of all the ministry names. His job is literally to rewrite history. Day after day, he alters old news articles, photographs, records, making people disappear from the record, making them unpersons.
So he knows firsthand that everything is a lie. He's part of the machinery of deception.
And that knowledge is what eats away at him. It fuels this secret, burning hatred for the party, which leads him to his first huge act of rebellion.
Which seems so small at first, but is monumental in that world.
It is. He buys an old blank diary from a junk shop run by a seemingly harmless old man, Mr. Charrington, and he finds a corner in his apartment just out of sight of the telescreen.
A tiny bit of privacy.
A tiny, precarious bit. And he starts writing. He writes, "Down with Big Brother," over and over.
That's thought crime, isn't it? The ultimate offense.
The ultimate. As Orwell puts it, thought crime does not entail death. Thought crime is death. The moment he thinks it, let alone writes it down, he believes he's doomed. It's just a matter of time.
So this initial act opens the door.
Yeah.
And then his attention starts to fixate on two other people, Julia and O'Brien. Let's start with Julia.
Right. Julia works in the fiction department. She's much younger than Winston, seems very vibrant, very conformist on the surface. He actually initially fears her, thinks she might be a spy.
But she turns out to be different.
Very different. She's rebellious, but in a completely different way to Winston. Her rebellion is personal. physical, hedonistic. She hates the party because it stops her from having fun, from enjoying herself.
So less about overthrowing the system and more about finding ways around it.
Exactly. She understands how to survive, how to break the rules secretly. And then comes that incredible moment where she slips him a note, just folds it into his hand as she passes him.
And the note says,
I love you. Just those three words. And for Winston, who's been living in total isolation and fear, it's like a bomb going off. It shatters everything.
It's a fascinating contrast, their motivations. Winston is searching for the why, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why does the party do this?
Yeah.
He wants intellectual understanding truth.
Yes. Whereas Julia is all about the how. How can we meet? How can we enjoy this moment? How can we carve out a little space for pleasure? Their affair becomes this intensely dangerous political act because, well, any loyalty, any love outside the party is forbidden.
As the book says, sex itself becomes a blow struck against the party.
Precisely. It's creating a private world, a loyalty the party can't control. At least that's what they hope.
Okay, then there's the other figure Winston obsesses over, O'Brien.
Ah, Brian. He's the opposite of Julia in many ways. He's an inner party member, powerful, intelligent, seems sophisticated. Winston sees him across the room sometimes, catches his eye, and feels this connection.
He projects onto him, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He desperately wants O'Brien to be on his side.
Totally. He convinces himself O'Brien is part of the legendary Brotherhood, the underground resistance movement led by Emmanuel Goldstein, the party's arch enemy. O'Brien has this charisma, this air of understanding that Winston finds irresistible. He sees him as a potential mentor, almost a father figure in rebellion.
Which, of course, sets up the most devastating betrayal later on. But first, the trap.
Yes. O'Brien eventually approaches Winston, seemingly confirming Winston's hopes. He invites Winston and Julia to his luxurious inner party apartment.
A glimpse into a completely different world of privilege.
Absolutely. And there, O'Brien confesses he's part of the rebellion. He tests their commitment, asks them horrifying questions about what they'd be willing to do.
And they agree to everything.
Everything. Then he gives them the book. The book. The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism, supposedly written by Goldstein.
This book is crucial. It explains the system, doesn't it?
It lays it all out. The how and the why of the party's power. It talks about the perpetual war being fake, just a way to use up resources and keep society on edge. It explains the structure, the inner and outer party, the proles.
And it introduces key concepts like newspeak and, critically, doublethink.
Right. Doublethink is maybe the most important psychological tool the party uses. It's the ability to hold two completely contradictory ideas in your mind at the same time and believe both.
Like knowing the Ministry of Truth produces lies, but also believing the party is infallible.
Exactly that. Or knowing the Ministry of Love is where torture happens, but accepting its name. It's a way of destroying logic, destroying objective reality itself from the inside out. Cognitive dissonance made mandatory.
So Winston finally gets this intellectual framework he's been craving. He reads the book with Julia in their secret room above Mr. Charrington's shop.
Their little sanctuary. That room is full of old objects, things from before the party, symbolizing a lost past. Winston even bought a beautiful glass paperweight with a piece of coral inside. It represents that fragile private world they've built.
But the sanctuary is an illusion.
A complete illusion. As they're reading, a voice suddenly speaks from behind a picture on the wall. An iron voice.
The hidden telescreen.
Always there. Then soldiers burst in, smash everything. The glass paperweight shatters on the floor.
Symbolizing the end of their hope, their private reality.
Completely. And the final sickening twist. The seemingly kind old shopkeeper, Mr. Charrington, walks in. But he looks different. Younger, colder. He was thought police all along.
The betrayal is total. O'Brien later tells Winston he had been watching him for 7 years. There was never any escape.
Never. The surveillance was absolute.
Which leads us to part three, the Ministry of Love.
Yeah, possibly one of the most harrowing sections in all of literature. The Ministry of Love is where the party deals with dissenters. And the key thing, the lights are never turned off. Ever. Constant light, constant observation, even inside your own head.
And Winston is subjected to brutal, systematic torture. But it's orchestrated by O'Brien, the man he thought was his ally.
O'Brien is his interrogator, his torturer, and in a twisted way, his teacher. And this is critical. O'Brien explains the party's philosophy. The goal isn't just to punish Winston or even to get a confession. It's to convert him.
To change his mind. Yeah. To make him accept their reality.
Not just accept it, to love it. O'Brien makes it terrifyingly clear. A party seeks power for its own sake. Not for good, not for wealth, just pure, absolute power.
This is when O'Brien delivers that line, isn't
yes.
it? The image of the future.
Chilling. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
It just cuts through any idea that this is some kind of misguided utopia. It's pure domination. Forever.
Pure nihilistic control. And under this physical and intense psychological pressure, Winston starts to break. O'Brien holds up four fingers, insists Winston sees five.
The infamous 2 + 2 = 5.
Right. It's about surrendering the very concept of objective truth. If the party says 2 + 2 = 5, then it is 5. Reality is whatever the party dictates. And eventually, under torture, Winston starts to see five fingers. He loses his grip on his own mind.
But there's one final step, isn't there? One last bit of his humanity they need to destroy. Room 101.
Room 101. It's different for everyone. It contains, as O'Brien says, the worst thing in the world. Whatever your deepest, most primal fear is.
And for Winston, it's rats.
Yes. They bring in a cage filled with starving rats designed to fit over his head like a mask. And faced with that ultimate horror, that unbearable terror, Winston breaks completely.
He screams.
He screams, "Do it to Julia! Do it to Julia! Not me! I don't care what you do to her! Tear her face off! Strip her to the bones! Not me!"
That betrayal, it's the final severing.
It's the absolute destruction of his love for her, his last connection to another human being that isn't controlled by the party. They've broken his loyalty, his final inner core. That's the victory O'Brien wanted.
So, looking back the whole arc, what are the main takeaways? The big things that still resonate so strongly? I mean, language seems crucial. Newspeak.
Definitely. Newspeak isn't just about simplifying language. It's about shrinking the very possibility of thought. By eliminating words for concepts like freedom or rebellion or individuality, the party aims to make the thoughts themselves impossible, unthinkable.
Like, if you don't have the word for freedom, you can't even conceive of being free.
That's the goal. It's linguistic engineering as mind control. Plus, you have the blatant contradictions in the ministry names. Peace wages war, truth tells lies, love tortures, plenty causes starvation. It's institutionalized irony or doublethink in action.
Okay, so language control. Then there's the manipulation of history and memory.
Absolutely fundamental, that core party slogan. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. By constantly rewriting history, erasing inconvenient facts, making people unpersons, the party ensures it is always right.
There's no external reality to check against. History becomes fluid, whatever the party needs it to be today.
Precisely. Which means objective truth just ceases to exist. And the third thing, maybe the most heartbreaking, is that destruction of loyalty we just talked about.
Winston betraying Julia.
Yes. The party cannot tolerate any deep bonds between people love, friendship, family, because those loyalties compete with loyalty to the state and Big Brother. They systematically destroy them.
And the ending reflects that total destruction, doesn't it? Winston, after he's released.
He's cured. He sits in the Chestnut Tree Cafe, a place associated with broken revolutionaries. He's drinking victory gin, tracing 2 + 2 = 5 in the dust. He even encounters Julia again.
What happens?
They have this incredibly bleak, empty conversation. They both admit they betrayed each other, but there's no anger, no sadness, just indifference. The connection is completely gone. They feel nothing.
The personality's been hollowed out.
Completely. And then those final devastating lines, he sees a poster of Big Brother.
He had won the victory over himself.
He loved Big Brother. That's the ultimate horror. Not just obedience, not just fear, but genuine adoration for the power that crushed him.
Yeah.
The conversion is total.
It's such a powerful, chilling end. I think the story really hammers home that the most critical battles aren't always fought on battlefields, but inside our own minds.
Yeah, and it serves as a constant reminder, especially now, about how easily language can be twisted, how history can be rewritten, and why we have to stay vigilant about protecting truth and independent thought.
Absolutely. Vigilance is key.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.